I'm Sam Ismail, the producer of the Vintage Computer Festival. I'd like to thank you all for coming today. I'm hoping you're having a really good time. I am. And I'm here to introduce to you Mr. Ray Holt. And Ray's going to share with us today a very exciting, well, for us it's a discovery because it's the first time. This is pretty much the first public viewing of the technology. The technology Ray is about to go over was developed over 30 years ago for a top secret Navy project. And ever since then, Ray's been trying to come out and speak about it, but the Navy kept saying no, no, no. And finally this year, we got the approval to, it was declassified, and Ray's allowed to finally talk about it now and share with you this pretty amazing technology, even today in today's terms, if you compare it, from the era that it was in, and it's amazing stuff. Ray will go into more of that. What I wanted to start it off with, though, is to read from a paper or from a an analysis or review that a man named Russell Fish did of Ray's work. We sent out some review material to numerous microprocessor luminaries and engineers and people who are in the know about this sort of thing to get their opinion of, ask their opinion of what is this? Is this a microprocessor? What do you think of this work? And I think Russell Fish was one of the design engineers of the Motorola 6800 processor back in the 70s. I think Russell Fish's comments really kind of lend the best description to what this is. So I'm just going to read from what Russell said. And I need to stop hitting the wrong buttons. This is what he said. Well, this is in part what he said. His document was actually rather lengthy. Their architecture included many advanced features, including execution pipelines, built-in boundary scan self-test, math co-processing, and multiprocessing. Their ROM included its own program counter, 7 years before David Chung at Fairchild did the same with the F8. Their PDU and PMU chips, and Ray will explain what those are later, are probably the world's first math coprocessors, a concept reintroduced by Intel with the 8087 in 1979. And he goes on to describe reiterate what the military requirement was of this project. The computation requirement was staggering for the time. Very small, very fast, very smart, and very rugged. Many computers of the same vintage executed instructions in the range of 500 kilohertz to 1 megahertz at room temperature, required 100 or more watts of power, and consumed 5 or 6 cubic feet of space. The Navy required computing power more advanced than the leading mini computers of the day, shrunk to the size of a paperback book, and able to perform in boiling water. Heat is the enemy of computers. The electrons inside transistors bump into each other more frequently at high temperature, slowing them down. Today's PCs will drop dead if the fan quits running long before the temperature of boiling water. The most popular mini computer of the time was Digital Equipment's PDP-8, a 12-bit machine. 12 bits means that the computer could count to 4,095. To control the F-14, the Navy required a 20-bit computer which could count to 1,048,575. Simply stated, given the 1968 state-of-the-art, the specification was not possible to meet. What was required was a significant advance of the state-of-the-art. And Russell goes on to talk about the solution that Ray and his team arrived at. 3 decades later, Mr. Holt's solution must still be viewed with awe. It is by any definition a technical tour de force of the first order. In light of today's $400 toilet seats, the central air data computer must be considered military procurement at its best. Furthermore, it is unfortunate that the project was classified, since if it had been incorporated into a commercial product of the time, it could have certainly dominated the mini computers of the time in real-time process control and possibly could have accelerated the microprocessor industry by 5 years and digital signal processors by a decade. So Ray is now going to elaborate on these comments that Russell Fish made, and I think you should keep those comments in mind as we Ray goes in to the description of his work, and I think you're going to be excited. So here is Ray Holt, designer of the what we're dubbing the MP944, which was the microprocessor for the the central air data computer that went into the F-14.
Great, thanks for coming. What's that? We're going to talk in part about the airplane itself, because the airplane obviously... The airplane and the requirements of the airplane influenced what we did. And the architect of the computer I'm going to talk about was definitely built around the airplane, even though we built it for general purposes. It did have to participate in making this airplane go. So this is the F-14 Tomcat, and I'm going to be talking about the microprocessor chipset. It was one of 3 to 5 computers that was on the airplane. This particular computer, just in general, read pressure, two types of pressure, static and dynamic pressure, and our whole system had the pressure sensors. And it also read temperature, and from that, those three pieces of information, through the right mathematics, we were able to determine altitude, what's called true airspeed, dynamic airspeed, and temperature, and we drove the position of the wings, we drove the flaps of the plane, and we also displayed to the pilot that information. As well as we fed information to the other systems on the plane so that they would know what altitude and speed and angle the plane is at when they'd like they fired their weapon system or they had to communicate. So it was the central data processor of the airplane itself. Now you need to get your mindset right, because this is 1998. We started this project in 1968. So you kind of need to know what was going on back then, certainly in terms of some of these items, but you also need to know that where we were in the technology. Microcomputers, microprocessors, LSI, MOS, those were foreign words to just about every designer. We were in the middle of the Vietnam War. You can see our country was in a disarray. Noyce and Moore founded Intel later that year. Floppy disk was announced. We had no floppy disk to do this product, nor hard disk, as you because that wasn't out. The Altair company, MITS, was founded, and Bill Gates became a teenager. So that's where we were. So keep that in mind as we talk about this, because some of this stuff, even though it's pretty dramatic for the time, today it's pretty common. But I was fascinated to hear Mr. Rojas speak here, because what was done in the 30s and 40s was really fascinating. Especially since he had no partners to work with, and the stuff that was created back then was created from the mathematics. And that's pretty much what we did too. We started with the mathematics and the basic concepts of logic, and then we just pushed the technology as much as we could, as much as the suppliers would let us push it. And of course, I'll say right up front, we had the advantage of the Navy and your taxpayer dollars, because they poured money into this project to make it work. Making it not work was not an option. And going into it, I guess I was young enough, I didn't know it wouldn't work. And probably the rest of the people on the project too, and there's a couple here I'll introduce a little bit later. It just had to work. And we had a time frame to make it work. So June 1968 is when this project was started. What did we do? We designed and developed a central air data computer. Again, not the only computer on the plane, but the one that was central in collecting data. It was a new integrated circuit. Now, here's where we came from. When I hired on at this company, they walked me down to the manufacturing line and they showed me this box. It must have weighed 300, 400, 500 pounds. They opened it up. It looked like a huge transmission to me. I was an electronic engineer. They showed me this mechanical monster. I looked in it. It was shiny chrome gears and cams and potentiometers. And they said, "Do you know what that is?" And for a moment, I thought I hired in at the wrong company. I said, no. They said, "That's a computer on an F4. Your job will be to replace that mechanical computer with a large-scale integrated computer." That wasn't my job alone, of course, but I was part of the team. And that's how it started. So we were not given the option. We will do that. And I learned within the first day or so that through the brilliance of a mathematician we had on the project, Bill McCormick, that he could take mathematics and take it to hydraulics, he could take it to mechanics, he could take it to electronics. He knew how it can be done. So he took these mathematical equations, which we'll see some of them later, and he told us how they needed to be implemented, and then it was our job to make them into digital logic. So we did it for the U.S. Navy, the F-14 Tomcat. The prime contractor from the Navy was Grumman Aircraft in New York. I worked for a subcontractor, Garrett Air Research, out of Torrance, California. Now, at this time, I wanted to introduce the two of the gentlemen that came that was on the project. Tom Redfern, raise your hand or stand up or whatever. Please feel free to talk to him later. Tom was manager of the circuit design group, and they were in there with us, and there's some analog circuitry that goes around this, A to D conversions, D to A's. The technology of those pieces were as state-of-the-art as this computer. And it's unfortunate some of this military work doesn't get out. But even being a digital person, I was impressed with the analog work. And Jim Lawless. Oh, by the way, Tom works at National now. Jim Lawless is a professor at City College San Francisco. And Jim worked on the simulation of the computer, some failure analysis. And can you believe that we simulated a digital computer in Fortran? And Jim was reminding us last night that because of Fortran, we had to assign 1 bit of digital as a 32-bit word in Fortran because it didn't have logical capability. No wonder it took all night for it to run. Okay, June 1968 we started. We completed the entire project June 1970, and the airplane took its first flight in end of 70, December 21st. This is the airplane right before takeoff on the first flight. And of course, now most of us are familiar with this plane. It's been the major plane for the U.S. Ever since. Okay, Garrett Air Research had the contract for the central air data computer and the microprocessor part, the integrated circuits. We worked with American Microsystems here in Santa Clara, who is not around right now. I think they stuck around till late 70s, early 80s. They did the chip design. Now, again, keep in mind, Intel wasn't around. National was here. Fairchild was here. General Instruments, American Microsystems. As I remember, most of them didn't really want to touch this project because you don't make money on military projects. You suck your resources up. You lose market position. None of them really wanted to work on it. And from my recollection, and maybe Tom can clarify this, but Garrett had to go in partnership with American Microsystems. So they actually bought 20% of their stock at the time in order to induce AMI to work with us. And in trade for that, they put their sharpest engineers on the project. Hopefully, I thought two of them would be able to come, but they couldn't. One works at Intel now and one works for AMD. So we worked with AMI. Okay, what is a CADC? I got three slides here to let you know. First, we were to compute data and drive the displays of the airplane. Second, we were to compute data and drive the moving surfaces of the plane. And third, we were to take that data and then transfer it to the other systems on the airplane. Okay, the requirements of the aircraft, it was one of the first to have a two-man crew where they were front and back of each other. Everything was redundant on this plane, down to the crew. Two engines, it had weapon systems well beyond what I can even describe today. Had an internal gun, kind of like a Gatling gun, and it could land on an aircraft carrier fully loaded with all their weapon systems. That was a requirement from the Navy. This I just found out a few weeks ago off of an F-14 website, but I'm not surprised about this because some of this pressure came down to us, and it was in the form of, you will not be late. That is not an option. Now I know why. This are the penalties that was put on Grumman. $440,000 for each 100-pound overweight. We had to take this $300-400 pound mechanical computer. We were only allowed 70 pounds for our entire computer, A to D converters, sensors, and we were totally redundant, so we had two of everything in there, including the weight of the case, 70 pounds. For each second slow in takeoff, probably what affected us the most was the maintenance hours. We had to have a highly reliable system, and we had to prove it, and $5,000 for each day late. So those were the pressures that was coming back on us. And the airplane ended up being on time, on cost, underweight by 0.6%, better performance than expected. And this is a tribute to Grumman and their engineers. The fact that it was on time is a tribute to all the subcontractors, I think. First flight was 1 month ahead of schedule, and it was demonstrated operational to the Navy in half the time frame. Okay, right now I'm going to show you clips from two films. One's a Navy informational tape that was put out, and then the other one, most of us have probably seen Top Gun. And I must say, the first time I saw the movie, I didn't even know the plane was in it, and I was just in awe to see those wings move and everything. Of course, I was there thinking of all the digital calculations going on. But it was fascinating, and even to this day, to see this plane fly is fascinating. So it's about a 3 or 4 minute clip to give you a feel for the environment that this computer was working in.
Night Fleet air defense fighter in the world. It is a variable sweep-wing supersonic fighter with a speed exceeding Mach 2, or two times the speed of sound. In combat, it is armed with 14 air-to-air missiles, including 6 Phoenix, 4 Sparrow, and 4 Sidewinder missiles, plus a 20-millimeter Vulcan cannon. The F-14's advanced AWG-9 weapons control system is capable of controlling the 6 Phoenix launches while simultaneously tracking 24
for the full time of flight of the missile, whatever you're firing. We can prepare ourselves to take on the rest of the threat. It's one of a kind thing.
No matter how sophisticated, no weapon system can get the job done unless you have time to deploy it. And this means early detection. A high-powered radar and extremely fast digital computer provide the F-14 with almost 3 times the detection volume of current fighters, at 30 to 50% greater range. But this is no numbers game. Extended range means more time to respond, up to 2 extra minutes for a Phoenix to intercept a Mach 2 threat. The difference, perhaps, between winning and losing. In this age of automation, the tendency is to put everything you can into a computer. For certainly, computers have taken us over hurdles we never could have handled otherwise. But there are limitations, as we all know. Thus, the F-14, though highly automated, with a computer system that can process 3 times as much information as any other fighter, still relies on a two-man...
What you got, kid?
I lost him. I'm looking. I got him. He's on our tail, coming hard. Yeah, I got him. Here we go. Talk to me, Goose.
He's still back there. He's closing in on us. He's closing fast.
You can run, kid, but you can't hide.
Jester, see if I can give you a run for your money here.
Watch the mountains!
How many thought about the computer working during that? I didn't think so. I still do. You spend 2 or 3 years of your life at the bit level on that. It's hard to get away from it. Okay, let's get into a little detail now. For those of you that are not into the computer field, you'll probably still enjoy this. But this is what it takes to implement a computer on an aircraft like that. Okay, we were to compute and display altitude, airspeed, vertical speed, Mach number, and temperature. That's what went back on the display for the pilot. Okay, we were to control the speed of the wings, so the rate at which the wings moved. We were given feedback on the position of the wings, so that after we drove the wings to a certain position, we had to detect whether they actually got there, and that they were synchronized. Of course, they had hydraulics and mechanics to synchronize them too. And then the rate at which, because you can't move them because of the weight and obvious mechanics of the wings, we only can drive them at a certain rate. And if the pilot tried to go faster than the wings can move, then he was given some warning too. And the idea is as the plane flies faster, the wings are swept back more to reduce the drag on the plane. And also there's a supersonic airstream that comes off the nose, and as it comes off the nose, if the wings are sticking out into the airstream, either the plane becomes unstable or it starts burning off the tips of the wings. So you had to make sure the wings were in back of that airstream, and especially true as it goes towards the speed of sound, Mach 1, or twice the speed of sound, Mach 2. There's some units called the glove vane. They were little surfaces that came out the front of the wing to help push that airstream further out so the plane can have a higher lift at the higher speed. So we control that, and then the angle of attack, so the angle of the plane. Now all this information, especially the angle of attack, was important, like to the weapon system, because the weapon system needed to know where the plane was and where it was going, so as it released these missiles, it didn't drive the missile back into the plane. Obvious importance, right? So we fed that information to the weapon system. The flight computer provided critical data to these other systems. We also had a requirement for a complete in-flight self-diagnostic. So this processor was programmed to completely diagnose itself, and we had two of them in the system. It was redundant. So if we detected a failure in one, the logic in the box would switch over to the other one. And then a light would come on the pilot dash and say, you're on your last computer. And then they had a choice to continue the mission or to not continue the mission. Okay, the requirements of the Central Air Data Computer We had a requirement, we only had 40 square inches on a PC card. That's equivalent to what I'm holding up here. The entire computer had to fit on there. Now, because of the PC card and the material it was made out of at the time, we can only have 10 watts of dissipation. Now, 10 watts is like nothing. You know, light bulbs are 75 watts. So 10 watts of dissipation for the entire central processor, microprocessor. The cost, our cost on a per chip basis, this is not the development cost, and I'm not sure what the development cost was. My guess would be $30 to $50 million. But our cost was $3,000 to $5,000 for the chips themselves. Chips ran between $100 and $200 each after they were developed. Temperature, this is the most amazing part about the whole thing. We had to operate at mil-spec temperature range. So it's minus 55 to plus 125, and that is not room temperature, you know. All the PC designs today, they all operate at what's called consumer or commercial specs. And then we also had to consider acceleration, mechanical shock. I mean, this whole box had to be dropped from a certain height and everything still had to run. Reliability, and then we had to stay on schedule. Now, acceleration and mechanical shock, in the time of LSI in 68, that was crucial because on these chips, you had to bond wires from the chip to the package. And the bonding had to survive this acceleration and shock. And so a lot of planning and consideration was put into that by the engineers at American Microsystems to make sure that the technique they used would satisfy the military requirements. So there was a lot of state-of-the-art going into not only the architect of this, but the actual chip design. Okay, what state-of-the-art did we have to work with in 68? TTL bipolar was the choice, and of course a lot of aerospace computers and ground computers, many computers were built out of that. It was fast, but the disadvantage is it consumed a lot of power. Plus it was not highly integrated, so it just takes a lot of space for all these circuits. Second, there was MOS chip modules, but you could only get four gates or 10 logical gates on a chip, and a couple of flip-flops are called, and I mean, you know, you definitely couldn't get a whole arithmetic unit on. And then we had an option of LSI, but it was new. You know, the words and the concepts was probably a year or two old, but it was an option. American Microsystems, National Fairchild, they were making custom chips. In fact, custom was the big word. You know, standard product was nothing, custom, because you get a lot of development dollars for these custom chips. And given the requirement that we had to do this, LSI was the only way to go. Let's see, could I get the lights on? I need to read some stuff here. At the time I was working on this project, I remember doing lots of research because I wanted to make sure that what we were doing was the very best we could do. So one thing I did is I collected a lot of articles at the time, and I put them in a binder, and that was one thing I've saved all these years. So I have some quotes out of there that I want to read to you. These are all relevant quotes about the technology, just so you can get a mindset of where we were at the time. Okay, Jack Fischel, the first one. This is out of Flight Control Research, Electronic Technology Magazine. It was a briefing he did for the industry in May of 67. The primary flight control system configuration now being used, an electromechanical hydraulic combination, has proven to be fairly reliable. However, the rate of advancement of the fly-by-wire, now fly-by-wire is a concept of flying the plane by electric wire. There's no direct connection between the pilot and the flying of the plane. Advancement of the fly-by-wire system rests entirely with the electronics industry in providing completely reliable, low-cost, easily maintained systems. Joseph Earl. Actually, I think his name is Earl Joseph. Yeah, Earl Joseph. Today's computers, this is October 67. Today's computers use integrated circuit components containing at most 10 gates per component. However, LSI is introducing hundreds of gates per component and will eventually evolve into thousands of gates per component. To the aerospace planner, this technology breakthrough of LSI means tremendous reduction in cost, size, weight, and power consumption of logic components. However, for the aerospace planner to successfully implement aerospace computers with LSI, the designer and manager must reorient their methodology and goals. A multitude of new design and cost considerations must be carefully scrutinized. Higher speed, smaller system, greater reliability, and lower cost will stem from this. The designer must be forced to organize the logic components in a fashion that will minimize the number of pin and interconnect. And that was very true for us. In an LSI component where many logic nodes exist, multiple logic node failures are likely, such as when a crack propagates through the chip. And with the work Jim and I did on simulating the, we went through and we simulated single point failures on every active gate and every node in all these chips. And we were 98% successful in developing a series of test programs to test 98% of the failures. Sam Levy, October 67 from IEEE Transaction. The system architecture problem is one of maximizing the benefits of reliability and speed to be derived from utilizing the LSI technology. GC Feth, how large is large scale is not fully agreed upon. Is it 50, 100, or 200 circuits on a chip? What are we talking about now with the Pentiums? Is it a billion yet? I don't know. You know, 30 years ago, they're talking 200. That's LSI. Is it a computer on a wafer, or is it simply a level of integration just a little beyond what is obtainable today? And the last gentleman, Franz Alt. Most computing systems of the last two decades have had a fundamental structure proposed by von Neumann. They consist of a certain number of registers connected to a memory on one hand and to an arithmetic unit on the other hand. However, for computer designers to reassess the situation and to think in terms of arrangements in which either the memory and the processing functions are more intimately connected, or in which there is a strong parallelism, even to the extent of having hundreds of arithmetic units. So he was challenging the industry at the time to don't consider just a central processor, but consider a lot of them running in parallel. And his comments, as well as Gordon Bell in his book Computer Structures, talks a lot about parallelism on computers, highly influenced us, because the technology was not there for a single processor to go fast enough to do all these functions. So we had to have multiple processors running at the same time, and that's pretty much what we ended up doing. This is the, go ahead and turn the lights down. This is the block diagram of the complete central air data computer, not just the microprocessor part, but the complete computer. So we had two pressure sensors, static and dynamic pressure sensors. The sensors were identical, but one detected from different parts of the plane. Now, as I remember, the dynamic pressure was like at the nose of the plane. It was the force pressure the plane was going through. Static pressure was like underneath the body of the plane, where the pressure was fairly stable and not dependent on speed. The development of these sensors, they're called quartz sensors. It was a quartz diaphragm that was deflected slightly, ever so slightly, with pressure. The technology was probably 10 times more advanced than the microprocessor. And Tom was instrumental in working with the designers on that. They had to detect one part in a million on pressure sensors, so that's the 19 bits. And even today, that's probably quite good. Well, these were state-of-the-art pressures developed by Garrett Air Research. Those sensors fed into an analog-to-digital converter, which converted to 19 bits, and that fed into the computer. So we received a digital word that represented those two pressures outside the plane. And then over here, there was a temperature probe, which was converted to digital. And then the pilot has had the options to feed us some information. For instance, the pilot could force a self-test. Rarely did they do it in dogfighting, of course, but if they were just coasting along, they could do that. But on the ground, they could force a self-test before they took off as a last-minute check to make sure everything's working. The pilot also had they had what they called a thumb wheel control of the wings. So the pilot could sit there and actually move his thumb and through our computer force the wings to move. Now, we had control of, if he wanted to move them too far forward for the speed he's going, then we would stop him from doing that. But at least he could make the wings go back further based on his speed. So that was the input we had. The CPU memory unit was the microprocessing unit, including the self-test. Then we had some interface to some ground equipment. And then our digital output fed to a digital-to-analog converter. And so this continuous analog information was then fed to the flaps and the wings, and of course then to the hydraulics and the mechanics to actually move the wings. And so our job would be to take this information and feed it through some complex mathematical equations that implemented curve functions, and to check limits and to check boundaries and various things like that, and then to drive it back out. Okay, let's look at the microprocessor itself. These are arithmetic units that we had to perform, or arithmetic functions that we had to perform with the microprocessor. So the standard multiply, divide, subtract, and square root. Okay, we had logical functions, ands and ors, every computer does that. We had to do conditional and unconditional jumps and transfers. We had to read information from switch closures. We had to read information from analog to digital converters. And then we had to send switch closure information, you know, lights on the front, on the dash panel, and digital to analog converter to drive wings and flaps. Okay, let's look at the self-test, because this is still very unique to this design. We came up with, through our simulation, and we put a significant amount of time in the simulation. Now remember, we had to actually get the design done first, and then in Fortran write a program for every logic gate in this computer. And there ended up being 73,000 logic gates, or active gates. So we had to simulate all those to make sure that when we determine how to test, that we would end up with the right requirement for Grumman and the Navy. So our self-test, our in-flight diagnostic, is 100% on every connection and every data path on the PC card. Every 100% of the ROM bits, and these are all single failures, of the ROM bits, 100% of all the non-arithmetic units, because we had some units that controlled the data paths, and then 98% of the arithmetic units. And you'll see in a minute, our arithmetic units were not just standard 1-bit, 2-bit, 4-bit, or even 8-bit arithmetic units. This is a 20-bit machine, so our arithmetic units were 20-bit arithmetic units. So they're quite complex. There's a lot of gates on it. So we ended up with 98% of the single failures. It was a dual redundant system again, so there was two of everything in the box. And we had to notify the pilot if there was any error. Now, one thing I found out is that if the pilot received a signal that says the computer's not working, he could actually force it not to switch over too. So if he wanted to continue determining that that error doesn't affect anything, like he's on his way back and was landing or something, he could choose to continue to operate off that computer. Because once it switched over, then you couldn't switch back. Okay, here's an example of the majority of the calculations that we had to program in. There were 6-order polynomials, and if you're into mathematics, you'll know that polynomials can be used to estimate the shapes of curves. So we had to do 6-order polynomials, and the input, the variable into the polynomial, were the values that we received from the sensors. We had to check limits on values, so we calculate values and then we'll check to see if they've reached a certain limit or not. For instance, moving the wings forward, we had to make sure that they didn't go beyond the required position based on the speed. So it was an XY function, speed versus position. We had to do data conditioning and scaling. The entire numerics of the machine was 2's complement, similar to the German machine here. And so everything was a decimal point. And so we constantly had to scale data. So there was a lot of calculations to keep the data within the range so we could keep the accuracy of the calculations. Okay, so the number system was fractional fixed point computation, 2's complement arithmetic, and 20-bit data link. Okay, the microprocessor chips were made out of P-channel MOS, the most basic early technology at the time. It had its limits on speed, it had limits on line spacing. There's a lot of limitations to it. So every time that we tried to re-architect the machine or we had to make it go faster, American Microsystems engineers would come back and say, no way, you can't do that. We can't even make it. So we'd have to go back and we'd change the design. So there was a constant trade-off between what can we make and what was required. When we first laid out this computer, it was a standard von Neumann single processor. We'll just run it as fast as we can and we'll get everything done. And I think, as I remember, we were asking them to run like at 2 megahertz or something. Well, we ended up at 375 kilohertz. So, you know, we were asking them to do something like 6 to 10 times faster than the technology would allow at the time. So consequently, since we couldn't go fast enough to do everything, we had to start backing up and saying, okay, how can we do more things at once as opposed to a whole bunch of things at one time? We had package count to deal with because we had this 4x10 PC card everything had to fit on. However, when you do package count, when you have package count problems, obviously you like to put it in the smallest package. Well, when we did that, these chips were running too hot for some of these packages, so we're forced to go with the bigger package. So it was a constant trade-off, you know, which chip do we put in which package, and sometimes we had to change the architect to do that. Well, the obvious thing with your designer is that you want to eliminate the number of pins, the data transfers between the chips. So we went away from parallel transferring of 20 bits of data to serial transfer. So inside the chips, we operate 20-bit parallel, but between the chips, we transfer data serially. And that just tremendously reduced the connections between the chips. And then again, we had to operate at mil-spec temperature range. And I just want to emphasize that that's a major consideration. I mean, you may have a great design, and you may want to try to make it work at room temperature, but when you start designing chips to work over this wide temperature range, plus acceleration and shock, you're only using about half the technology that is possible at room temperature. Because American Microsystems would come back and they'd say, well, that'll work at room temperature, but that plane gets hot, these are going to stop running. So we had to like back off, and we had to make sure line spacings would operate. And so there are a lot of considerations. Okay, design decisions that we made, we had to have it programmable, so read-only memory programmable. We knew, they knew, Grumman, Navy, Garrett, we all knew there was going to be changes coming along because the whole concept of this plane with the wings moving, it was new. So they didn't want us to like redesign random logic to, so we had to have a programmable machine. Again, we went serial because of the pin count. We had a distributive instruction set, and I'll show that in a minute. We had several processing units going at the same time. They each had their own instruction set. Of course, everything was synchronized. And then we did pipeline concurrency on each of the units. They each received their instruction for the next instruction while the last one was going on. Again, something Zeus had. When you did your talk over Haas, it was just like I was getting ready for mine. But Mr. Zeus did it, 30 years before this. So we pipelined the instructions. Also, the previous pipeline, the word pipeline is used in a lot of places in computers, but if you have multiple instruction units running, Gordon Bell called that pipeline concurrency, but you can also pipeline your instructions in operation. While the unit is operating the last instruction, then you feed it the next instruction. So we had both of those going on at the same time. The ROMs that contained the program that drove the arithmetic units, they were all synchronized by a master set of ROMs. that told them when to go and when not to go. Because we found out that on some of these processing units, some of them had a lot of dead time. Like we had to do a lot more, as I remember, divides and multiplies. Well, the divider was sitting there doing nothing. Well, on a synchronized machine, you have to still step through your ROM with dead code. Well, we found out it was better to have a master set into the ROM and do conditional jumps. Okay, here's the clock detail on the chips. We ended up with 375 megahertz clock. And each 20 clock cycles was one word. And so it took two words to do a complete operation. The first word was shifting the instruction in. Second word was doing the operation. And then we overlapped those as we went along. So every two words, which was 106 microseconds, we would do one instruction. And then we did 512 of those. So every 512 of those, we recalculated the entire plane's functions. And then that turned out that that was, at that rate, everything was done 18 times a second. So every 1 over 18th of a second, we calculated all functions of the plane. So when we were driving those wings, we were driving them in increments of 1/18th of a second. So those discrete little steps. But of course, when it gets filtered out through D-to-A converters, it just looks like a continuous move. And as I remember, the requirement was we had to do it at least 1 every 16th time of a second. So we were just a little bit faster than required. So given all that data, the entire computer operated or performed 9,370 operations per central processing unit per second. And you'll see in a second we had three CPUs running in parallel. So there's a lot of performance capability there. The key was, can we make these chips to make it all happen? So this is what we ended up with. Six different chips. A parallel 20-bit multiplier unit, a 20-bit divider unit, and the multiplier unit, for those of you that are into math and logic, it was Booth's algorithm from a book called Johann Chu is where I got it from. And it was a book just full of techniques on implementing math to digital. The divider was called non-restoring division. Again, exact same logic that we talked about in the earlier talk. Our special logic function, even though that's the name we gave it, it was really, it had all the elements of a central CPU. Our data steering unit, because we were serial, there was a lot of serial data passing around this computer, and so we had to guide it between the units. You know, the output of a multiply had to be guided to the divider, and so we had what we call the steering unit, which is basically a multiplexer that would, during the right clock times, would steer this data. RAM, which we called random access storage, and read-only memory. So those were the six chips that we developed. This was the layout of the F14 microprocessor. Now I say the F14 microprocessor because we designed it as a general purpose chipset. You see, we have three arithmetic modules demonstrated here. Well, it was designed to have 16 total. So the chips would actually allow that. So here's the multiplier with its own RAM, and then a digital multiplexer to select which data input goes to the multiplier during the next instruction cycle. Then we have the divider unit and its own RAM with the data multiplexer guiding the data into its arithmetic unit. And then the special logic function, and I'll look at the details in a second, but basically it did ANDs and ORs, all the standard logic. We had to do two's complement conversion. We had to do a gray code conversion. So we had arithmetic logic in there. We had arithmetic. We had logic. We had instruction decode. And we had three registers in there. So that was basically, under today's definition, that was the CPU. These were like coprocessors. And then driving all of this was a set of ROMs with programmed instructions that told every unit what to do. And then here's our executive control. This is another ROM, the same exact modules as these, but these were programmed to start and stop these at the right time. And again, by start and stopping these, we found out that we could save enough space in these to justify having an overhead executive control. So that was the entire unit, and we'll look at the number of chips and everything in a second. Well, this is the general purpose. So if you were to design a general, not a general purpose, but a more expandable system out of this, basically you could go up to 16. Now, the concept can go much further, but the problem we ran into is as you start tying these ships together, capacitance problems, loading problems, and various things like that. So given the exact ships that we had, the limit was 16. Okay, this was the requirement for the F-14 configuration. Now, this is requirements per second. And remember, this is the 18 times a second. So in a second, we had to do 5,490 20-bit multiplies. 1,222 20-bit divides, 293 add and subtracts, 1,373 comparing limits and boundaries. And then all the way down, we had to read the switch inputs 842 times and read or write to the analog digital converters or DDA converters 694 times. I think your battery's going down on this. Unlike on the F-14. Now, fortunately at the time, I wrote a technical manual. At the time, meaning in 70 when we finished the project, I sat down and wrote this manual, and I figured out how much of the computational capability we were using. Otherwise, today, I probably wouldn't be able to figure it out. But this is the maximum capability of the configuration. So you see, in the worst case, we were only using 50% of the capability of the machine to do the F-14. So we still had room to do about 4,000 more 20-bit multiplies. So the machine was actually sitting there. The multiplier was sitting there 50% of the time doing nothing, or just computing bum data is what it was doing. And a lot of these other units, there was a lot of flexibility left in it to expand the computer or expand the requirement of the plane. Okay, the parallel multiplier unit. This is what was inside the chip. It's a 20-bit multiplier. So we had three registers. Two of them we shift in, the 20-bit operands. Every clock cycle, 20 clock cycles, we could compute a 20-bit multiply, and the results would go into the third register. Pipeline overlap, while we're doing this 20 clock cycle, computing the last, and then the instruction for the next one is coming in. Booth multiply, I mentioned that earlier. So the multiply actually occurred in 53 microseconds, but then it took 53 microseconds to shift it out. And it was continuously operated, so the multiplier and divider received no commands. It was just operating all the time. All we had to do is feed it good data, and then we had to know when we did that so we know when good data was coming out. So basically, that's more like a coprocessor today. They're just always running. You just feed it data. Okay, this is a picture of the chip. Again, it's 1968. It was a marvelous layout. And I can tell you now, they didn't do it the first time. It took several iterations. And for those of you that were around back then, it was not all automatic. It was all hand laid out. It was about as big as this wall, all these Ruby layouts. And I remember spending a month or two, I lived down in Torrance, but I'd fly up here to work with them. A month or two, we would just check my schematic against this big layout. And these guys were on ladders, yellow marking this thing. And I was yellow marking the schematic. We'll make sure every gate, every layout was just perfect. Because really, we had to do that. It had to work the first time. If we had to turn these chips around two or three times, we would not have made the project. Now, just to let you know, now up front here, I have actual chips, actual photographs. So if you want to look at it in more detail. Okay, the divider was very similar. 20-bit divider, three registers, same pipeline overlap. Same continuous operation, except it did divide. And this is the divider chip. Look at all that wasted space there. And you know, that bothered the layout people too, but sometimes that just happens. Okay, the special logic function. It did logical and arithmetic operations, grayscale conversions. The grayscale conversion was for a special communication. I guess the military has a special communication scheme, so we had to convert to a special code to transmit out to that. And it had the internal registers and the same pipelining, and it operated in 53 microseconds, the actual operation, and then the other 53, we shifted the commands back and forth. So it had a 4-bit. So I had 16 instructions it did internally. So this was the, this is more like the single chip microprocessor. However, I'll be the first to say it wasn't general purpose enough for consumer applications, but it did have all the elements of the processor. And this is the chip. Now the line spacing on here, like the tight line spacing, the lines are 10 mils wide, 10 thousandths wide, and 10 thousandths spacing. Tom, what do they get today?
Oh, submicron.
Submicron? Which is like 0.13. So we're talking, what, 1,000 times? Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
In fact, the mineralization now, rather than looking, the capacitance between the metal lines is orders of magnitude higher than the capacitance down to the substrate.
Also, instead of having flat metal, they're tall.
Yeah, except it's all plain, it's all filled in, but it's these, like Grand Canyon. The aspect ratio is completely changed.
Okay, the steering logic unit, this is the multiplexer, had 16 possible inputs, so we could take data from 16 possible places, DDA converter, multiplier divider, logic unit, and feed them into one of the other units. And so we had a 15-bit instruction word to steer 16 inputs to one of three different outputs. So the same input could go to all three, or three different inputs could go to all three. The programmer decided where the data is going to come from and where it's going to go. And that was part of the programming. And here's a picture of that chip. Okay, the random access storage, or today the RAM, random access memory. So we had 16 20-bit static registers. We could randomly access any one of the 16. So after we did like a multiply, we could store the result in one of 16 registers for that multiplier. So we could hold 16 previous calculations, and then we can pull it out and then reuse it for the next calculation. See, we had these polynomials to calculate, and there was a lot of intermediate values we had to store. Plus, there was 16 to 32, I can't remember, different calculations we had to do all at the same time. So we get partway through one calculation, and we had to stop it and then read the input from the sensor to start another calculation. So we had all these partial calculations going on at the same time, which doesn't really affect the plane that we're doing it partially, because we were updating the systems 18 times a second. So we were like calculating in discrete modes, but we're sending out a continuous stream. And so we had a 5-bit word to control the 16 registers, 4 to select the registers and 1 to select read or write. And this is the RAM. And that was pretty marvelous layout and technology at the time. I think most of us that are into the technology are familiar with Moore's Law, Gordon Moore from Intel, that every 18 months the density on the chip doubles. Well, his law starts in 71, of course, when the Intel had their stuff. But if you were to take, and that's a linear line, if you were to take that line and go backwards, then this chip here should have been about that big in terms of density. I think this had like 2,500 devices on it, and according to Moore's law, it should have only had like 1,000 or 1,200. So it was a marvelous layout, and it was marvelous pushing the technology. And the last circuit that we did was the read-only memory, and this was the stored program, or we had a lot of constant numbers, constant limits, boundaries, and parameters in all these equations that we had to store. So each ROM was 128 20-bit words, and that was a stored program, and then we could chain up to 8 of those together at one time. So each arithmetic unit module could have 1,000 instruction words for each one. And we only had to use about 3/4 of that. Now, it had a lot of nice features, which for the time was pretty nice. We could clear the program counter. We could increment or decrement it. We could put it on hold, or we can send an external address in. And I've already been told by some patent people that a lot of this didn't come till middle or late 70s. And then, of course, we had data in, and we had parity out. Parity is a method of checking whether your bits are accurate. And so we had that built into the ROM, and that fed to our self-test circuitry. So if any one bit goes off due to failure, then we could tell that there was a problem. And that's how we could 100% check the ROMs. Okay, and here's a picture of the read-only memory. So that's not a flaw in the chip. That was a dirt piece of dirt when we took the picture. These were photographs of the first chips that came off the line. And I believe the examples I have here are the ones we took the photographs from. Okay, here's the specs on all the chips. Okay, these are the sizes. They were a little bit large for the time. Most consumer chips were coming out around 120 or 130 in size. A lot of them were under 100. I remember AMI, they didn't want to go over 100, but they ended up doing it for us. They said, well, if you allow us to keep these, ease up on the design rules, the layout, then we'll go to bigger chips. When you do chips like this back then, the larger the chip, the less the yield, which means you get fewer of them working off of the wafer. So because they'd already quoted us an estimated price, the larger the chips got, the fewer they got and the higher their cost. So there was a lot of negotiation on that. The package size here, this is how many of these we used in the system. So one multiplier, one divider, one special logic, three steering units, one for each of the modules, three storage units, and then 19 ROMs to store the program. So 74,442 devices or active transistors and 28 different packages. Now the surface area of all these chips is about 7 square inches. And then when you allow the leads and everything, so it's like 12 square inches. So 12 square inches is pretty small, but of course you can't make it work in that space because you have to interconnect everything. And so that's how we ended up with, that's how we're able to get them all working on a board this size. Here are pictures of the actual chips. So four of them we put in larger packages. These two mainly due to the power dissipation. And these two due to the number of connections we had. And these we just had to keep down because there was so many of them in the system, especially the ROM. It had to be a 14-pin package. Otherwise, we wouldn't fit everything on the board. Here's our instruction set, or the number of instructions we have. The multiplier and divider continuously ran, so there's no instructions to drive that. The special logic function, 16 different instructions there. Special logic unit, 48 different instructions for the steering logic unit. So those were instructions to guide the data from one device to another. And then the RAM, the random access storage, had 32 instructions for selecting which storage register. And the executive ROM, now since there's a microprogram unit, you can kind of define your instruction set. So we ended up with 37 instructions, some of which said, told the DDA converter to start converting, or A to D, and then others told the DDA converter, okay, now we're gonna send you data, and so we controlled all the input output there too. So there's 133 instructions used in the F14 implementation of this chipset. This is a typical equation. This was the equation for calculating the angle of the plane. It's called the angle of attack. So as the plane moves, you know, it has vectors, x and y vectors. So we're just constantly recalculating 18 times a second what angle this plane is at. Now, you might want to know why that's important. Well, when you're diving and you shoot a missile off, You don't want the missile to come back and hit your plane. So we're feeding this angle of attack information to the navigation or to the weapon system to make sure they fire this missile away from the plane. And if you watch some of those movies, you know the missile just kind of drops and then it takes off. And that's what they're doing. They're forcing it away from the plane and forcing it to the point where it doesn't come back on the plane either. So this equation is what drove that. And so it's a standard vector. It's mx plus b, if you remember your algebra. But to calculate the slope, it was a lot of information. And then these were the, let's see, oops. I'm not sure how to go back here. Okay, we'll just go forward here. So once we had the math equation, then, well, let me say, now I don't know if I said it earlier, the whole machine was hand programmed, bit by bit. We made a drawing like this, which flowed out. Every box represented an operation time in the computer. So we decided that the multiplier would multiply here, and you would do nothing there, and that we would send the result of the divider, the quotient, up to the multiplier here. You know, so we just mapped out every operation time, which the entire mathematical process of which chip's going to do what. So we just called that the flow diagram. And then we had sheets like this, which I developed, and we just hand-programmed all the bits. You know, we had to guide the quotient from the divider into the multiplier at the right time, and so we'd hand set all these bits. And that's how we programmed the unit. We had no assemblers, no compilers, no simulators, no debuggers, and no hardware prototype to start with. So we actually had to develop any tools that we needed. And it was a trade-off. You know, we talked about, do we do an assembler? Well, it was pretty quick. I mean, we knew pretty quick that to develop an assembler for a multi-processor kind of computer would probably consume the whole 2 years. So we had to trade off. And what we decided was we would hand code the machine. We would write a simulator to make sure the chips work. And then we had a version of that simulator that we drove the instructions through to make sure the logic of the program worked. Now, again, this is all in Fortran. And then we had a third program to simulate the failure analysis. And then we had a fourth program to actually draw back out on a plotter this flow diagram you just saw. Okay, so these are basically the aids that we had. So we had the failure analysis simulation, which Jim Lawless did. The program simulation Jim and my brother worked on. We had to punch out card decks. Remember, no floppies? So somehow we had to tell American Microsystems how to make these ROMs. So they told us their requirement. So from our simulator, we had to punch out a card deck, which we would give them so they can make the ROMs. It was like a 3-month turnaround on ROMs. So we had to make sure it was right. That's why we had to simulate this. We knew if we were wrong too many times, the plane was not going to make a schedule. And then we had a program to do the flow charting and the testing the software. And then we actually did a hardware prototype, which I'll show you at the end. This was our printout from our simulator. So every operation cycle of the machine, we knew exactly what values were going into the multiplier and what values were coming out. Every cycle. And we checked everything out ahead of time. We checked points on the curve, we checked limits. So we actually simulated the plane. Now, of course, we couldn't simulate every possible condition. First, we didn't have time, but second, there wasn't time for the computers to run. And Jim reminded me that it was costing us $1,800 an hour, Jim, yeah. to rent this outside computer, because Garrett didn't have enough computer resources to simulate all this. This is the printout of the ROM patterns that we gave American Microsystems. This is the plotter printout of the flow diagram. So each block here was one operation cycle. And so this program was written. Did you get involved in this, Jim? Or did Bill do this?
Bill did.
Yeah, I think near the end you did. But we had to feed the program what configuration we had, and then the program just stepped through that whole configuration. And so it printed out values for us at each point. It told us the data paths. So this is really, really valuable in troubleshooting. Here's a picture of our mock-up. This is a real live working model. Here are the pressure sensors here. I'll show you blow-ups of that in a minute. This was the, now this wasn't the actual unit, this was the prototype. And we had to prototype type the chips out of standard modules from General Instruments. So these were 4 gates per package, 6 gates per package. And then this was the mock-up of the displays that the pilot saw. Now one little story, I've only told a few people then, so all of you guys will know, but 2 days before, see, I think on a Thursday, the generals of the Navy were going to come and see this working. And that weekend, I had plugged the power supply in backwards. Every chip on this went out. My wife is here. That's probably the week you didn't see me for 3-4 days. We only had 4 days to get it working again. Well, we knew that it worked if we got good chips back on it. The problem was General Instruments was on allocation on these parts. You just couldn't go down to Fry's and buy them. I mean, you had to order them. You had to wait for a cycle to go through, manufacturing cycle, to get these chips back. Then you had to unsolder all these and solder more back on. Then you had to troubleshoot your soldering. But we knew the wiring was good. And the purchasing people, Garrett and all the engineers, everybody, I don't even know if you remember this, Tom, but everybody got on the phone. They called customers of General Instruments, see if we can buy back chips. And they did everything. As the generals were walking in, we found the last problem. I mean, we were seeing their eyes. I can remember looking up, and here they're walking in, and we just found the last problem, and we just kind of acted cool. And but we made it, and I mean, they don't even know that all this happened, and just a few people besides you guys. So this was the mock-up of the unit, and this was... this is right after that demonstration. So those are the new set of chips. Here's a close-up, and it's a little blurry, but I had to zoom in on that picture. This is a close-up of the sensor, so there's identical quartz sensors here. Now, in the actual airplane, there was a cover over this. Here's a close-up of the prototype board. I think we had two or three boards per final chip. That's how it ended up. And you can see if we had developed this with standard technology, I mean, there's no way these boards would fit in the airplane. And it would actually be a more unreliable system, too, because there was so many interconnects. Here's the panel. So we have vertical speed here, altitude, Mach number there, true airspeed. I'm not sure. That's the other airspeed. And this is altitude here, and that's vertical speed. Okay, and the ultimate test of the computer and the aircraft to see if it's really going to work. Here's the airplane going through Mach 2. Wings are back, and everything working. So that's it. We'll take some questions. Also, if some of you want copies of these slides, if you want to leave a business card or leave your name and address, I'll be happy to do that. Also, I've set up a website. It's called microcomputerhistory.com, and the entire F-14 information's up there. And so you can, and I'll be continuing to put more on there, more details. One of the documents, the technical document I have, has not been released by Garrett yet. And the reason for that is they can't find anyone that's willing to sign off on it because everybody's new to the company. But they have found one person that is going to look at it, and he may be willing to do that. And so some of this technical information I'll have on the website, too. Yes?
Why did it take so long to declassify this information? And what were sort of the...
That's a good question. It's even becoming more of a good question because Dean Takahashi, who's back there, he wrote an article for the Wall Street Journal, which came out last Tuesday. And through his investigation, the Navy is claiming in writing this entire project was never classified. Now, common sense would say that's not true. Why would the most state-of-the-art aircraft in the middle of the Vietnam War not be classified? You know, I'm saying, you mean I could take all this information and just start selling it? Well, obviously that's not the case. So we know there was some level of classification. My knowledge was it was called confidential. It wasn't secret or top secret, it was confidential. In 1971, I wrote a paper on this entire computer, submitted it to Computer Design Magazine. They accepted it for publication, and Garrett and the Navy refused to sign off on it. So I could not get it published, and that paper is on the website. Also in 1985, I called the Navy office, the F-14 office, and I told them what I did, and I wanted to get the information released. The answer was a very strong no. It wasn't like, I'll check into it, it was no. And so I just kind of backed off, and finally, I guess just because I figured sooner or later this has to be declassified, April of last year, 97, I called the F-14 office. A young captain got on the phone. He says he was in charge of the F-14. And I asked him, I told him what I did, and I asked him if we could declassify this. And he said, now, tell me this again, you know? And when I finally explained it to him and he understood it, he really just started laughing. He says, this thing should have been declassified a long time ago. I suspect he was younger than the airplane and probably couldn't even imagine that it was still classified or considered classification. So he helped me. He started working through the process. It took a year. So April of this year, I received a copy of my paper with a stamp on it, a simple stamp, Naval Air Systems, okay to public dissemination, and they signed it. And I had to go through my local congresswoman to speed it up. So why it took so long, it was probably a combination of there was no reason for them to tell anybody when it was declassified. You know, if I would have pursued it every year, then maybe in late 89 it could have been, or early 90s. But, you know, after a while, it's history. Really, to me, after 85, it was history. I mean, there's no reason technically for me to pursue it. And even now, the reason I'm here today, the reason Sam's interested, is history. You know, I think as computer designers, as those interested in history, you need to know that this happened back then, or and that we could do things with this technology. And since this is a plane that's important to this country, it's kind of nice to know what was in it and what was making it happen.
I have two questions. How big was the team that developed this?
I came up with about 25 that worked on all parts of the central air data computer, from sensor, A to Ds, D to As. There was more people in the company in our departments, but they were working on other projects. But from managers down to technicians, about 25. There was two of us doing the logic design. There was two or three doing A to Ds and two or three doing D to As, technicians, managers, programmers. So it was a combination.
The second question is, in light of the fact that you know so much about the computer, do you think the F-14 is year 2000 compliant?
Absolutely, because it has nothing to do with dates. There's not a single date calculation in there, and I can assure you that. So if you want to fly during the year 2000, fly an F-14.
Was there only one version of the F-14?
There's about six versions now. This was on the F-14A, which I understand, again, I just found out from a website this summer. 575 was made, and believe it or not, it said on the website, the last 30 are scheduled for upgrading. Now, I'm not sure I wanted to fly a plane with 30-year-old chips in it, but that's what it said. But it's also hard to tell, because when a plane goes through a version upgrade, you don't know if it's the weapon system or the electronics or what. It's hard to tell. But no, there was more than one version, and this was for sure only in the first version, because the technology changes a lot, and I know they wouldn't keep this in. Plus, the requirements of the plane changed, and so they go through different things.
Marcus? Yeah, Ray, the swing wing is crystal clear what your computer was doing, the swing wing concept. I'm a little confused on things like autopilot. With the information you had in that computer, and were you controlling the aircraft if the pilot turned it over to this computer, or was the pilot always in control and you were just feeding him information?
Right. We did not drive the throttle, you might say. That was strictly the pilot. Now, he might have mechanically been able to put it in auto throttle, but we didn't do that.
Did that have anything to do with your computer? Was there another computer that did autopilot?
If it was in there, and I don't know if it was, it would have been another one.
Another.
Yeah. The only feedback that we got was the pilot trying to move the wings further than they were, and the position of the wings. because the Navy was really careful that we didn't, that if the wing wasn't, didn't go in the right position, that we notify the pilot. So we didn't drive anything else.
Ah, you notified the pilot, but then he had to act on it. Is that true?
Or did if we told the wing to move to a certain position, yeah, if we told the servos to move and they didn't from their feedback, then the pilot would know that. Of course, the plane probably wouldn't be flying right either, and he'd know. But, okay. Tom and Jim, any comments that I might have missed or any things in your memory that from those days? A long time ago, we're right. It's been a challenge to remember this much, but fortunately, I had a lot of it written down. Okay, well, thanks for being a good audience.